Greetings, and welcome back to The Africanist. I am your host, Bambanjai, and today it's a pleasure to be back to present to you another great conversation between two Africanist scholars. And do not forget to follow us on social media. We are on X, formerly known as Twitter, and our Twitter handle is TheAfricanistB1, the letter B and the number 1. You can also follow us on Facebook and feel free to reach out to us via email at theafricanist2020@gmail.com. theafricanist2020@gmail.com. To my colleagues in the US, I hope that your semester is winding down smoothly, and congratulations to students who are graduating this semester. Today, you will be listening to a great conversation between Nyaradzai Mahashi and Dr. Matthew Riri. Nyaradzai is a graduate student in art history at Emory University with a focus on African art. Her research interests include contemporary Southern African artists, artists' guilds, and the market in which they feature their work. And Dr. Matthew Riri is an associate professor of African and Black Atlantic art history and also the chair of the art history department at Oberlin College in Ohio. Dr. Riri recently published his first monograph entitled Insignificant Things, Amulets and the Art of Survival in the Early Black Atlantic, Duke University Press, 2023. This is a wonderful book, and I recommend to all of you guys to order your copy and ask your librarians to also order their copies. So big shout out to Nyaradzai for organizing and hosting this episode. I'm very grateful for that. And also thank you to Dr. Matthew Riri for having accepted our invitation. To learn more about Dr. Riri's research and his recent monograph, here is his conversation with Nyaradzai. Enjoy.
Hello, my name is Nyaradzai Mahashi, and I'm a first-year PhD student at Emory studying African art history. My research interests include contemporary Southern African artists and artist guilds and the markets in which their works are featured. I'm also interested in museums and the representation of these artists in museum collections. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Matthew Riri, who is the Associate Professor of Art History at Oberlin College in Ohio. So, Dr. Riri, welcome.
Yeah, Nyaradzai, thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
So Dr. Riri teaches and researches art history of the Black Atlantic world with a focus on connections between West Africa, Brazil, and Portugal from the 17th through the 21st century. Dr. Riri's writings have appeared in multiple academic journals and edited volumes in Duke University Press, where he published his first book, which we'll be discussing today. And this book is called Insignificant Things, Amulets and the Art of Survival in the Early Black Atlantic. Dr. Riri is a lifelong Midwesterner and a fifth generation Ohioan. He is a proud product of the US public education system from elementary through to graduate school. We're just going to begin this talk by talking about the book, and I wanted to start by asking you to give us a brief description of your book and just your writing process as you were working on the book.
The writing process, that's a different question. We'll get to that. So the book, as you said, the book is called Insignificant Things, Amulets and the Art of Survival in the Early Black Atlantic. It's broadly a story about disparate groups of African descended people, primarily from the late 17th through the early 19th century. They're movements in between and across what we could call the Portuguese Empire. So between West and Central Africa, Brazil and Portugal, like I said, primarily in the 18th century. But it's also a history of the visual and material objects that they interacted with in this nexus and made primarily. So the story of the book and its central kind of case study, kind of object, is what are called bolsas de Mandinga. These are Mandinga amulets, is how you would popularly render it in English. And these are small, protective, apotropaic amulets that were both produced by the people who are the main protagonists in the book, as well as purveyed and sold. And so part of the investigation, part of the research, is to figure out how we would contextualize these objects, these bolsas de Mandinga, in Black Atlantic art history broadly, in the history of slavery, and how we can ask questions about them as archival sources and archival materials related to the lives of the people who made them.
Thank you so much for that description. So when I was reading your book, I really appreciated the amount of detail and information and work that you put into explaining the boles. And I was curious to hear more about how your study of the Mandinga amulet speaks to the translocal and transcultural dialogues of assemblage of identity in the Black Atlantic?
Yeah, this is a good question. And I appreciate this word translocal, if I can start with that. So let me sort of take the question a little bigger and then zoom into the specificity. Because I think in one sense, this book would not be possible if I weren't standing on the shoulders of what is probably about a decade of scholarship now that has really been thinking about kind of micro histories in the Black Atlantic. So there's been just some fantastic books that have come out in the past 10 or 15 years, which are using kind of individual biographies of people displaced from West Africa to the Americas and to Europe to think about how they are interpreting the cultural particularities and the deeply kind of local power dynamics and cultural practices in these kind of multiple contexts, and that their lives then become case studies for thinking about the linkages between these. So when you use that phrase translocal, I think it's something that's become a real kind of push in African diaspora scholarship. How do Mandinga amulets help us think about translocal and transcultural dialogues? So one of the kind of methodological problems in the book is just how we write about these objects at all. So the first thing to remember is that despite the fact that the book is 92,000 words, there's really only a few actual extant objects that are at the center of it. So interpreting and analyzing these becomes a challenge when we start to talk about the sources that kind of make them relevant or visible to us. And you know, maybe we can talk about that in a bit. But one of the things that the book really focuses on is descriptions of the contents of these amulets, right? So I make a pretty strong series of arguments that these amulets were intended to be kind of archives of the various cultural practices and even cultural traumas that were experienced by the people who made them, because the amulets have the effect of protecting against what their contents kind of materially reference or index. So what that allows me to do is then take an analysis of the contents and read it through what I know is the life experiences of the person who made it. So as a really good example, one of the main figures in the book is named José Francisco Pereira. That's his Portuguese name, right? We don't know his African name. He was born somewhere in West Africa, unclear where, probably around 1704. He was enslaved in Brazil, all across what was then the state of Brazil, the colony, for about 15 years before he was finally enslaved in Lisbon. And in Lisbon in the 1730s, he gives a series of testimonies that are recording the contents of what's inside of his amulets. And really strikingly, as one example, he claims that they included gunpowder and a piece of flint and a bullet, right? All of which are materials that reference like a gun, an actual firearm. And this was so striking to me because gunpowder was being heavily imported into West Africa, and specifically the port at Ouidah, right, in present-day Benin, where he had been enslaved probably around 1718 and 1719. And that's also a context in which a wide number of European-imported trade goods are being brought into that port to trade for human bodies, right, for human lives, specifically his. So in Portugal all those years later, to see him referencing gunpowder, right, strikes me as a deeply translocal reflection on the material dynamics of the slave trade that led to his displacement out of the continent in the first place. On top of that, he's also, and we can talk more about these, he's also creating these rather detailed drawings of what appear to be Catholic scapulars, Catholic amulets, and references to Christ's crucifixion, which I argue pretty strongly are not just his kind of general understandings of Catholicism. He had been baptized by the Portuguese, so that would perhaps make sense, but are actually reflections on particular kind of popular Catholic practices and public celebrations that he would have seen in Lisbon, just outside of the house where we know he lived, right? Both in Portugal and in Brazil in other circumstances. So reading the amulets as these kind of deeply personal reflections materially allows me to read their contents in dialogue with these particular kind of local practices. And I think that allows us to make much more precise arguments about, as you phrase it, like the dynamics of identity, the assemblage of identity, and how someone like José Francisco isn't necessarily seeing these diverse range of practices, backgrounds, experiences, right, in West Africa and Brazil or Portugal. He may not necessarily be seeing these as contradictory, but something that add on to each other, because he's constructing particular material references to them inside of these amulets and putting them in intimate conversation with each other, right? And maybe some of our disciplinary boundaries and frameworks wouldn't be as receptive, let's say, to understanding these as deeply in dialogue, the way that he may be placing them for us.
I think when we're thinking about translocal and transcultural dialogues, I think it brings up a point in your book where you resist like the stagnation of like African cultural practices and how there is a reinvention like across the Black Atlantic, like there's a reinvention of those cultures in different forms, like they keep evolving. They're not just careers of tradition, and it's not just like transporting one practice to the next. There is growth and evolution in that. So I think I would like us to speak more about the like how you view that issue of like resisting against a presentation of Africans as carriers of cultural tradition, and how your work shows these strategic reinventions of African products in their circumstances.
Yeah, thanks for that. Yeah, I think you picked up on one of my intellectual hobby horses, perhaps. Which is nice to hear, right, that you got this out of the book. I feel like you never really understand your real stakes as a scholar until you go through a big writing process like this, and you're like, oh, this is the hill I'm going to die on. And so here's the hill. Yeah, I believe very strongly that it is a historical mistake and even an anachronistic mistake to believe that people are necessarily always deeply tied to some kind of cultural practice that and then become resistant to others. I think this potentially places kind of artificial and anachronistic boundary lines on cultural practices in the present day that may not have been necessarily relevant to, let's say, in this case, people in the 1700s, Africans in the 1700s. But I also think a move toward understanding people displaced into the Atlantic world who grew up, let's say, on the African continent as carriers of an African cultural tradition also precludes them from incorporating new kinds of cultural practices, material assemblages, economic values, spiritual traditions, right, into their own kind of cultural arsenal. I think it on the one hand potentially precludes that. And I think that becomes a danger because then it reinforces this idea of Africa generally and Africans as static and passive carriers of cultural tradition who are intellectually vacuous, who are not inventive, right? So I don't know that that was necessarily a conclusion that I came to, you know, just in and of myself, but I think it derives from the material in the book, right? There is no sense, right, to return to somebody like José Francisco. There is no sense that José Francisco had this kind of set number of things that he believed were going to keep him sort of helpful and protected in his life. And there's a bunch of different reasons for that, right? So we can go into that a little deeper. On the one hand, I don't know that José Francisco would have used a term like African to describe himself, right? This is someone who was born in the context of a series of conflicts between neighboring kingdoms, Dahomey, Ueda, sort of potentially the rise of the Oyo kingdom, the rise of the Ashanti state in present-day Ghana, which was all a response to the increasing severity of the slave trade in that part of West Africa. So this is someone who would have been trafficked as a young child by a powerful kingdom and displaced out of his homeland. So from an early age, he's migrating, he's moving, and he's having to make sense and make do with what he sees, even inside the African continent, right? So the idea of Africa as a static place that he thinks of as his home, I think is not, doesn't come through in his own biography, right? At the same time, one of my broader kind of pushes in the art history of the Black Atlantic is we understand the art history of the Atlantic world, we understand the art history of the Black Atlantic as one of rapid and kind of revelatory movement of material objects and philosophical practices, right? There's been an extensive literature, let's say, on cabinets of curiosity of people in Europe who are taking and collecting a wide range of material and natural and visual and performative objects, right? Reassembling them in these kind of radical formations. And we don't understand that as an abandonment of Europeanness somehow, right? We see this as the emergence of new forms of seeing and new forms of classification. And what started to bother me was that so rarely are Africans understood as intellectual contributors or even leaders in this discourse, where they too are recontextualizing, they too are reinterpreting this wide range of visual culture in the Atlantic. And it struck me that that's precisely what's happening in the Manjinga pouches, right? So our question about when someone uses, collects, or interpret something, right? We don't always have a question of that being tied to that person's identity somehow. And yet, Africans always seem to have to answer questions about their identity practice and how they're situated culturally. But what I see happening in the Manjinga pouches is this radical reinterpretation, oftentimes, of not only the material objects that Africans like José Francisco are encountering, but a real interrogation of the power structure that goes along with them, right? If gunpowder is what's funding those wars in West Africa, for him to claim that as part of his own is a real critique of that system. For him to understand the role that the Catholic Church plays in Portuguese life, for him to start to reappropriate Catholic symbols is also a real interrogation of that power system.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting what you said about how Africans are often excluded in the dialogue of when it comes to their role in art making or in cultural practices. It always seems like they're, you know, they represent the old and like a strong cultural past that they have stuck to, and they have just, it's never really presented as evolving as much as it was. And yet, you know, with migration and trade, it's like those were exchanges and interactions that were going both ways.
Yeah, I mean, and just to continue the point, I mean, part of the reason that the first chapter is focused a lot on Africa, right? And in West Africa specifically, and it's about the, in one sense, the expansion of the Kingdom of Mali, the rise of human trafficking in the Sahara and the Sahel, and how that eventually morphs into European interactions on the Atlantic coast in West Africa. And part of the reason I wanted to start the book that way was to make the point, and it doesn't need to be made anymore. Obviously, I'm not the first person to do it. But that it's not like a farmer in the Sahel in the 1300s is waiting for Europeans to show up so their history can start, right? That by the time that the first Europeans are making their way to the West African coast, they are already interacting, right, with a place that is undergoing massive population shifts, migrations, internal displacements, the influx of new religious systems and cultural practices. So there is no society that is static, obviously. That's not how societies work. But it's also not a place where it makes sense to say like, oh, the Europeans arriving is creating this, like, I think, radical new cultural shift, that it marks sort of a identifiable turning point in the history of West Africa. Rather, Europeans are entering into what is already a very complex political and cultural system, and they're having to navigate realities inside of that, right?
Another question I have is about the title of the book, Insignificant Things. Like, the first part is really striking to me. Like, what made you come up with with that title? And how do you, 'cause to me, when I think about your title, I think about the amulets themselves. Like, they're things that you did a lot of work on, but they are things that can be easily missed, like they're small objects, you know. And I guess, what's the inspiration behind the title of the book?
Thanks. I had to fight for the title. There was they almost made me change it to the subtitle, Duke University Press. And I wrote a whole introduction about why I picked the title I picked. So I was really into it, and they were completely understanding, right? I said like, oh, I'd like to keep it, and here's why, and they were understanding. So I really liked working with Duke, and Elizabeth Ault, my editor. I need to give her a shout out for all the help she gave in the text. Anyway, yeah, I had a friend before they read the book email me complaining about the title, actually, Insignificant Things, and their complaint was that, like, you know, these aren't insignificant, right? These are really important. I can't believe you would title it that way. You're diminishing and downplaying their importance to art history, their importance to Black studies. And I said, read the book, read the title. So the title is actually a quote from a Brazilian police official in the 1830s who had opened up, and in the context of a trial, he had opened up an amulet that was being used by an enslaved West African man who had participated in a large rebellion. And the goal of that rebellion in 1835 was to overthrow the slavery system in northeastern Brazil. And it was a rebellion that had political connections to a series of wars that were happening in West Africa at the same time. And so many of the participants in this rebellion had worn these amulets, leather amulets. They had been confiscated by the police after the rebellion was suppressed. And so this police officer opens up the amulet and says inside of it, there's nothing but coisas insignificantes, right? Nothing but insignificant things. And it was such a striking quote to me when I read it, because it embodied a kind of contradiction, or not necessarily a contradiction, but kind of a double think that it was clear that was happening in the police officer's mind at that point. Because on the one hand, he had ample evidence that these amulets were some of the key material manifestations and some of the key even agents in what was to that point like the largest rebellion of enslaved people in the mainland Americas. He knew how important these objects were. And clearly they signified to this whole mass of people something critical and valuable. And at the same time, he stares at them and says, they're insignificant, they mean nothing, right? Which was, I think, his kind of overcompensation of that he knew they signified something. He just didn't have the language to describe what it was that they signified, right? So I made that the title of the book precisely because I was interested in how the people who made these amulets took the objects, the symbols, the quotations of those in power and used them toward their own ends. And it struck me that if I use the title that way, it becomes kind of a metaphor or a commentary on that same process, right? I'm taking the title by the official and sort of rereading it, right? Sort of against its own intentions. That's a kind of counter reading or against the grain reading that I find to be not just a methodology that I think is productive, but the methodology that the people who made these amulets, manjingueiros, what they were using too. So that's one. On the second hand, it also becomes a metaphor for thinking about art history as a wider discipline. I think there's a reason that these amulets have only started to gain the attention of art historians. And I'm by no means the only art historian who's working on these amulets, right? Cecile Fromont at Yale University, Vaniclea Silva Santos, who's teaching at the University of Pennsylvania, as well as an amazing group of graduate students who are up and coming, are all doing really fantastic work. Andrea Guerrero Mosqueda at the National Autonomous University of Mexico. They all deserve lots of credit for working on this topic. But it's only been recently that art historians have started to take attention to them. And part of that is that I think they're so visually benign, right? There are so few of them. They're so small. They challenge many of our expectations about what an artwork or something that's meant to be analyzed should be. And so in that sense, I started to make the argument in the book that I think they were designed to be insignificant. I think they were designed to avoid visual inspection by elites, by high-ranking officials, precisely because they were containers of esoteric knowledge that became really valuable for the people that were using them. And so they may have been thinking very carefully about what it would mean to design an object that was meant to avoid visual analysis. And if the origins of art history are in theaters of colonialism, in theaters of slavery in European institutions, then we may have some more work to do to think about the history of the discipline and sort of what objects have been deemed worthy of study and what haven't, right? And who's sort of made those decisions over time.
Thank you for that, Dr. Rary. That was my next question for you about how your work doing this challenges what the art history discipline like deems worthy of analysis. And, you know, because visually, like, you know, they visually you could miss them at times, you know, and unless you know that they contain something meaningful. And I like how you said they were designed to avoid like visual analysis, like because they're almost sacred in a way, because they contain meaningful substances inside them. And I think it's interesting that a lot of people are like working on these, because I think it challenges the art history discipline as a whole, like because there's so many things that are, I think, on the African continent that I usually argued against, like that this is more anthropology and not art history, and yet they do serve artistic they do have artistic functions like in them that are meaningful to different people, I think. So I really appreciate that. Did you have any additional comments you would like to make before we move on to the three concluding questions?
Oh, to the fun part, to the fun question. I mean, obviously, I could talk about these things all day. But I mean, the one thing that it may be good for listeners to know is that most of the images that are in the book are actually accessible online. So most of the amulets that I'm writing about, or at least the descriptions of amulets that I'm writing about, right, are produced in the context of Portuguese Inquisition trials, right, in Lisbon in the first three decades of the 1700s. And these are all at the Torre do Tombo National Archive in Lisbon, which has a fully digitized website. So you can go and read these trials on your own and in your spare time. And that's such important work to preserve archives like this. There are archives all across the Atlantic world, which are under kind of environmental and existential threat. And both environmental preservation and digitization projects, I think, are really, really important to undertake at this moment, not just for researchers, but for others. So I just got an email the other day from a Nigerian-American artist who's based in Los Angeles, who works with amulets and is interested in working with some of the images of the Mandingas and other Afro-Brazilian amulets as sort of part of her own artistic practice. So I'm really excited to see those synergies, right, start to morph and to take shape.
Yeah, and it's really interesting you say that, because I feel like these lately contemporary artists like from all over the world have been digging into archives, like museum archives, and giving us a new way to look at so-called traditional objects like in our contemporary times, and how it's been really exciting to see how a lot of artists are inspired by these works of art. So I'm really happy to hear that.
Yeah, and I think it just goes back to the points of, I think artists are always ahead of where scholars are. It just seems consistently true to me. And something that that I try to argue with the book is, those who made Mandinga amulets are anticipating a lot of present day theoretical discourses about the relationship between slavery and visual regimes of power, the relationship between visuality and racial subjugation, the relationship between kind of economic changes and religious pluralism and religious diasporas, and kind of the piecemeal or performative construction of identity formation, right? This is all recent cultural studies and Black feminist studies. They knew this in the early 1700s, right? So I think there's a reason that some contemporary artists are already starting to pick up on these, because they recognize themselves in these older objects, right? And they see a dialogue there that I think will be productive. So I'm excited to see what comes of all that.
Yeah, that is It's definitely exciting. Like, there has been a lot of engaging with traditional objects and navigating identity and just transnationality in general, since, like, especially with, digital access to things, like, it's really been sparking I think an exciting art scene that is going to inform the discipline in an interesting way. So I guess we can conclude. Thank you for answering questions about the book. So I'm going to ask you just three fun questions. The first one is, what are your top three novels?
So I have to say for all the listeners, Nyaradzai sent me these questions ahead of time, and this was so hard. I spent so much time thinking about this question, right? What are my top three novels? And I decided to go with maybe not even necessarily the ones that I enjoyed the most, but for some reason, like taught me the most about myself or that I still sit with, right? Because there's a difference between what you find enjoyable and what you find that pushes you. And maybe sometimes that's something you push against. So my top three that I came up with were Octavia Butler's Parable of the Sower, a collection of stories by the Haitian American author Edwige Danticat, who I hope everyone knows at this point, called Create Dangerously, The Immigrant Artist at Work, which is a text that I always return to when I need to remember why it's important to write. She has some really profound statements in the book about writing for yourself. And writing for those audiences that you may not even ever get to meet, that someone somewhere is going to need to read what you write. So never censor your own voice. And then the last one is a 1980s kind of quasi travel book by the British author Bruce Chatwin called The Song Lines, which is a story about him going to Australia and reckoning with the Aboriginal history of that continent and the concept of a song line as both a poem and a landscape and a method of history. It's a really difficult to classify book, part fiction, part nonfiction, part poem, part journal. But I think it has a lot to say about the questions that we ask as travelers through history and through time and geography and how those reflect back on ourselves.
Thank you. The next question is, what are your top three dishes?
This one was easier. I have lots of opinions about food, but this was very clear for me. Peruvian ceviche. I remember the very first time I was in the Andes on an archaeological dig, and I went to a family's house and they served me ceviche. And it was the first time in my life I ate something that I could not classify. I had no like palate experience for this. Just one of the best things I've ever had. And I've been chasing that kind of perfect ceviche ever since. I know I won't get back to it. I live in Ohio, right? We have good seafood here, but it's not the same. There's that. My second one is I will take an al pastor taco off a trompo, off a spit, right? Corn tortilla, cilantro, little onion, lime, and a little piece of pineapple any day. One of my favorites. And the last one is I come from a big Italian American family, and my family's pasta sauce recipe is sacred. And that will be my last meal, whatever it is.
Thank you so much. And the last question is, what are your top three countries you would like to visit that you've visited?
So I've been really lucky to travel a lot in my life. I think a while ago, many more African countries would have been on this list. But I've checked off a bunch recently. So as it stands, my current top three, the first one is Cuba. I wanted to go to Cuba for a very long time, and I just booked a trip. So I'm going to be in Havana on New Year's Eve. I'm spending 12 days there, traveling across the western half of the island in a trip that's going to be specifically focused on Afro-Cuban ritual and music. And I'm just bouncing off the walls excited for it. I'm really, really happy. The second one is probably Japan. Which had not been on my list for a very long time, but it's a location that's become increasingly important to a lot of people who are close to me. And that trip should be happening in June of 2024, right? So we're already planning, just had a Zoom call with some friends to plan that the other night. And the last one is, it's split between multiple countries, but I would really love to go hiking in the Himalayas. I don't even know if that's physically possible for me at this stage in my life, but I would really, really like to. Probably Nepal then, yeah.
Thank you for your answers, Dr. Rary. This was, I think, a very informative talk. And I look forward to seeing what you will write next. And thank you so much for joining us today on the Africanist podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. Luttons pour la paix. Quand j'aime Africa, mon laïna. Mané j'aime Africa, moi sonyo na tangue.